You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU's community radio station broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Forget conspiracy. Contrails are real and dangerous to the climate. From Sweden's Chalmers University of Technology, Dr. Daniel Johansson. While thousands died of heat in Europe in 2003, a marine heat wave ripped the North Atlantic at the same time. Changes to marine life remain today. From Germany, Dr. Karl Michael Werner of the Thunen Institute of Sea Fisheries in Bremerhaven reports. Meanwhile, the pillars of wealth remain oblivious at Davos. Full speed ahead, fossil fuel for a hot, militarized world. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Thanks for joining us. For a while, it seemed like money power got it. We were heading over the precipice of climate change and the limits of nature. Just 6 years ago, the chief executive of the world's largest pool of wealth, Larry Fink, promised at Davos to transform finance away from fossil fuels. Banks in many parts of the world made commitments, weak and gradual, sure, but promises to stop fueling disaster with more investments in fossil fuels. Most of the green funds and promises have been ditched. It's every country for themselves announcing emergency action on fossil fuels for nation building, national defense, and even new colonization. Here's a short clip from the New York Times reporter David Gelles on Davos, January 2026.
The World Economic Forum was ground zero for the birth of the climate movement on Wall Street. But this year, climate has really taken a back seat. And at the end of the day, the business community wasn't ready to sacrifice its profits in the name of combating climate change.
So how did this movement start?
Well, it began in 2020.
How do we frame an investment portfolio that will be able to thoughtfully navigate climate change?
The CEO of BlackRock, the world's largest asset manager, wrote a letter calling on the financial community in particular to take climate change seriously. In the years that followed, just about every major financial institution joined the bandwagon. You saw major banks, including JP Morgan and Bank of America, pledge to start reducing their emissions and start changing their lending practices to support clean energy and potentially even reduce their business with fossil fuel companies. So at the very time, you saw big firms introducing new products aimed at addressing sustainability and capitalizing on it. You had Republicans and conservatives around the country finding ways to try to stop it. And then President Trump was reelected at the end of 2024.
We're going to be crushing Biden-era environmental restrictions.
Since then, he has used his perch in the Oval Office to tamp down the clean energy industry in the United States, promote fossil fuels. And now we've seen many of the companies that said they were going to back away from fossil fuels instead line up and invest record amounts in the expansion of the fossil fuel business. So where does this leave us? Many of the people I've spoken to for this story say that rather than help solve the issue of climate change, it seems like Wall Street these days is contributing to it.
With executives and the richest of the rich in attendance, well, this year Elon Musk presented, Davos previously featured whole sessions on meeting the climate challenge. This year, I found only Trump's obsession with windmills and this short clip from Swedish scientist Johan Rockström.
With the three sources of scientific evidence that proves that we now have overwhelming evidence of the need to transition the global economy within prosperity, within planetary boundaries. The first one is that the human pressures on the planet has now reached a crisis point. The era where we can continue with economic growth without putting the stability of the planet at risk has come to an end. Welcome to the Anthropocene. The second is that these pressures on the planet are now at risk of causing irreversible, potentially catastrophic tipping points that would irreversibly drift away from the life support we depend on. And the third is that we are now understanding for the first time with scientific evidence, that our world economy depends on the extraordinary stability of the Holocene. We leave the last ice age 18,000 years ago and enter what you see here, this extraordinarily stable 12,000 year, which is a 14 degrees Celsius global mean surface temperature with a maximum variability. Can you imagine? A plus minus 0.5 degrees Celsius, which gives us the corridor of life that is the basis for all our life support.
That was it. Johann Rockström, almost from another room, trying to pierce the curtains, the willful blindness of men, and it is mostly men, at the top of the money machine. Climate? Oh, this is no time for climate. There is gold to seize, weapons, castles, and monuments to build. Outside, scientists who still have funding continue observations and calculations. The whole environment is changing with us inside it. It is difficult to keep up. Some underreported tidbits follow this week's guests. Let's take to the air. Business Insider tracked 157 private jets arriving near Davos as billionaires and world leaders flew to the Swiss Alps for the World Economic Forum's annual meeting. It was the busiest travel week in Swiss history. According to Greenpeace, the number of private planes this year was 10% more than last and triple the number in 2023. So let's investigate what those planes leave behind in the atmosphere.
Radio EcoShock.
Here is a puzzle for you. Flying causes about 2.5% of global carbon dioxide emissions, but it adds about 4% to global warming. Why? Planes also create contrails and high clouds that add to warming. Yes, those contrails, doing the opposite of conspiracy theory. Is there an opportunity here to reduce warming impacts from all our flying around? Our guest Daniel Johansson is lead author of the paper Contrails, Aviation, and Climate Change, published in Nature Communications. Daniel is associate professor at the Department of Space, Earth, and Environment at Chalmers University of Technology. Chalmers is highly rated, kind of a Swedish MIT. From Gothenburg, Daniel Johansson, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. I look forward to talk to you about contrails.
Well, most of us have seen white aircraft trails, and sometimes they do become high clouds. What is a contrail, and why does this happen?
So basically, contrail is formed behind airplanes, and it's formed on the water vapor in the exhaust, together with also soot coming out from the exhaust. And under some conditions, if it's getting cold enough, this water vapor will condense on the particles emitted from the exhaust, and this is what we see as contrails, basically ice particles formed on the soot particles from the engine. And under some conditions, if it's humid enough, these contrails will stay in the atmosphere for hours. So basically, for the contrails to form, it needs to be cold, say around minus 40 degrees Celsius, 45 degrees Celsius, and for them to stay around longer than a few minutes, it also needs to be humid enough in the atmosphere.
So we call these high clouds cirrus clouds. How long do they tend to last, and is it long enough to matter?
Yeah, so basically, we have these contrails that disappears quickly, then they disappear quickly within a few minutes. These doesn't matter for the climate. And then we have the contrails, the persistent contrails. They usually stay a couple of hours, up to, say, 10 hours or something like that. And if they stay even longer, they tend to form clouds that are indistinguishable from cirrus clouds. And then they can stay, say, up to 24 hours or even longer in the atmosphere. And these are the long-lived ones, the one that has a lifetime above a couple of hours, are the one that matters from the climate perspective.
We were told that clouds generally help cool the surface by reflecting solar energy back into space. Please explain why a high cirrus cloud stimulated by passing aircraft can create more warming than cooling.
So basically, all clouds, both low-level clouds like cumulus clouds and these high-level clouds, say cirrus clouds or contrails, affect solar radiation. It reflects solar radiation as we get less solar radiation towards the ground. So that is true for both these sort of low-level clouds that causes sort of the shade, and also these higher-level clouds that are usually thinner. But also all clouds absorb infrared radiation coming from the Earth's surface going towards space and block that infrared radiation going out to space. And this is the mechanism causing a warming from the clouds. And it turns out from basic physics that this warming impact of the cloud will be larger the colder the cloud is. And the low-level clouds, it's usually warmer. It's so warmer closer to the surface in the atmosphere. And the higher clouds, high up in the atmosphere, say contrails and cirrus clouds, are typically much colder. And for that reason, they have a much stronger warming impact than the low-level clouds. And it is the net effect of the cooling impact of clouds, the reflection of the solar radiation, and the warming impact of the clouds, basically being the absorption from infrared radiation, that determines if a cloud, on average, is a warming or cooling cloud. So even these low-level clouds, they are warming during nighttime, but daytime, the reflection of the solar radiation is much stronger than the absorption of infrared radiation, causing them to be a warming. While for the contrails, they're always warming in the night, but they also have the effect of reflecting at daytime. So some contrails at daytime can actually be also cooling, and some of them at daytime can have a warming effect.
So what's the overall impact, though? Is it more warming than cooling?
It's more warming than cooling. So contrails, on average, are causing a warming, and quite strong such a warming.
The introduction to your paper says, quote, contrail cirrus, which currently has an effective radiation forcing comparable to that of aviation CO2, end quote. That's a big statement. Half of aircraft-induced warming is from contrails and not burning fossil fuels. How do you know that?
So basically, this is a topic that has been researched for about more than 3 decades. Actually, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, released a special report on aviation and climate in 1999. And already there, they had this sort of assessment of the warming impacts of contrails versus that of carbon dioxide from aviation. So there has been research going on since then. And most of these researchers rely on models, climate models, or more specific models devoted for us towards assessing contrail cirrus. And these models show a warming, say, a radiative forcing, as it's called, reflective radiative forcing, that is on par with that of aviation CO2. Some models show a stronger warming of the contrail cirrus. Some are about the same for the contrail cirrus as that for aviation CO2. And some models point towards a slightly less warming of contrail cirrus compared to aviation CO2. So this is a sort of the source material for such a statement.
Are we at the point yet where we can predict and map specific conditions required to turn airplane exhaust into clouds?
Basically, from a statistical, a climatological perspective, we know fairly well where these contrails are formed. We can calculate statistically at which altitudes and over which seasons the chance of a contrail, a persistent contrail, is actually formed, and so on. But from a more, say, for a specific flight, it is much harder because it's hard to predict these places in the atmosphere where it's humid enough. We basically can quite easily calculate when it's cold enough, but we also need to know where it's humid enough. And this is much trickier to do forecasts on. So when it comes to actual changing flight routes and so on to avoid this area, it is tricky for the moment. We can do forecasts. There is some sort of possibility to redirect flights to avoid these areas, but it's still sort of pretty uncertain, and more research is needed to go into this specific topic.
But if we could do it, if a plane could avoid flying through contrail conditions with a diversion, that might mean more fuel burn, but it would reduce the overall impact on climate. It might be possible to do that?
Yes, that is sort of the hope from the industry and from many researchers for the moment, that this could be a mitigation option that could be also very low cost, basically that we can avoid theoretically a major fraction of the contrail forcing by emitting slightly more CO2 from the airplanes in the order of like a 1% additional fuel use or something like that, and then potentially avoid 50, 80, even theoretically up to 100% of the contrail forcing. But we are not really there yet, but it might be an option over the coming decade or so.
Your group also converted aircraft pollution into economic damages. What did you find?
So basically, what we did, what we wanted to understand, if the numbers we referred to before, that the impact of contrails being roughly in terms of the effective radiated force equally large to that of aviation CO2, is based on sort of past aviation and what forcing has caused up to now. But when it comes to a decision, if you want to sort of mitigate climate change, we need to understand what are the consequences of our mitigation strategies. If we are going to sort of emit slightly more CO2 to avoid the contrails, we need to sort of assess the climate damages we avoid from now onto the, into the future of our actions. We need a forward-looking perspective. And that was the reason why we adopted this sort of a climate economic perspective. My intention was primarily to understand better what are the consequences causing contrails in terms of economic numbers, and also what are the consequences of emitting CO2. And from those insights, we could get sort of a better understanding if it's worthwhile doing this sort of shift of avoiding contrail forming regions and emitting slightly more CO2. And what we basically found, if you look at the global total impact of contrail series and global total impact of 1 year of CO2 emissions from aviation, the climate damages of the contrails is around sort of 10 up to 60% of that of CO2. So this is sort of the comparison of the importance from this economic perspective of reducing contrails versus the impact caused by CO2 emissions from aviation.
And along the way, you have to use something called a discount rate. Please explain what the discount rate means in terms of climate damages.
So the discount rate is an assumption, as an approach that is used in climate economic modeling and climate economic reasoning. It's very central for climate economic analysis. It's basically, if you make an assessment of the climate impacts of, say, emitting CO2, what are the consequences of emitting CO2 in economic numbers? We have something called social cost of carbon. And when estimating this social cost of carbon, and we need to take into account what are the climate impacts in terms of numbers. If we emit 1 ton of CO2 today and add up all the economic consequences through basically the whole lifetime of CO2 in the atmosphere, so we need to analyze climate impacts over several hundred years into the future. When you're doing this type of analysis, we cannot just add up the numbers over time. We need to consider that it's quite likely that we will be better off in the future, we'll be richer in the future. And if you're going to estimate costs and benefits occurring now compared to costs and benefits occurring, say, 10 years into the future, 50 years into the future, and so on, and if we are richer in the future, we need to consider that the sort of the benefit or the utility we get from $1 extra 50 years from now when we're richer are worth less to us than the sort of having one additional dollar if we are poorer, for example. And this is the sort of the basic mechanism behind discounting, how to value costs and benefits over time, if you get richer over time.
On another topic, last January you co-authored an article asking a difficult question: should climate policy focus more on methane or carbon dioxide? How does warming from methane compare to carbon dioxide in the atmosphere?
So this is a topic that is sort of relatively similar to the issue of contrails, actually. So basically, contrails are very short-lived in the atmosphere. They have a stay there for a few hours, up to a day. Methane is a greenhouse gas. It stays there for, say, one decade, and within two or three decades, most of the methane emissions are gone. Say that we emit methane today, it will be largely gone within 30 years from the atmosphere. CO2, on the other hand, is a very long-lived greenhouse gas. So if you emit CO2 today, after 100 years, 30% of that impact will still be present in the atmosphere. And after 1,000 years, roughly 20% of that sort of emission will have an impact in the atmosphere. So these gases have very different properties in the atmosphere. And that was sort of the starting point for basically for the contrail paper we wrote that we have discussed so far, but also for the methane studies that we have analyzed. Sort of, we need to understand the sort of temporal dimension of the different sort of climate impacts and of the different gases and forces to also make sort of sensible and effective policies for meeting climate targets. And so this was a starting point. So methane is relatively short-lived compared to CO2. But when it comes to methane, it's a much stronger greenhouse gas than CO2. So if we look at the instantaneous impact in the atmosphere, if we emit 1 kilo of methane and compare that to 1 kilo of carbon dioxide, that kilo of methane is roughly 100 strong in terms of climate impact in compared to CO2.
It sounds strange to hear methane could be emitted in perpetuity. What do you mean by that?
So the thing is here that the starting point for the analysis and many of the climate discussion is that we want to stabilize global mean surface temperature at 1.5 up to 2 degrees Celsius above the pre-industrial level. This is the targets that are discussed within the Paris Agreement and so on. And the climate impact of CO2 is that it accumulates in the atmosphere. So every time we emit one additional ton of CO2 to the atmosphere, it will increase the temperature level of the Earth. And it will sort of have that increase, of course, that increase in temperature lasting for hundreds and hundreds of years into the future. And the mechanism here that if you're going to stabilize the climate, given the sort of accumulative nature of the CO2 emissions need to go to net zero. Without having CO2 emissions being net zero, we will never be able to stabilize climate or the global mean surface temperature. Methane, on the other hand, since it's so much short-lived, we can sort of emit methane and sort of have a stable climate. Basically, if we emit 1 ton of methane every year, we will sort of increase the concentration of methane initially in the atmosphere, but eventually it will come in a steady state with emissions we have, causing sort of a fixed level of temperature contribution from methane. And that is the key, is the reason why we can have sort of ongoing emissions of methane and a stable climate, while for CO2, we cannot have that situation. We need to sort of reduce the emissions to net zero to have a stable climate.
Well, if I understood your work correctly, the later we leave emissions controls, the less relevant methane control becomes compared to CO2. And so would it be more economically effective to invest in methane control now, say, as we reach 1.5 degrees C of warming, but maybe not later at 2.5 degrees C of warming?
So in our sort of relatively recent study on methane, the mechanism is that sort of we look at the climate impacts of methane versus that of CO2, and we're using these economic damages from climate change. And these economic damages from climate change, they are increasing with the warming level, and they're actually increasing faster than the warming level. So basically, when I talk about the marginal damages increases with the warming level. So basically, if you get a 3-degree warming, it will be much worse than just twice as much compared to a 1.5-degree warming, the damages of that. So we have this non-linear relationship between warming levels and damages. Based on such a reasoning, it becomes more important to reduce the CO2 emissions now compared to the methane emissions now. If we expect that we will have continued warming in the future, we will not have any stabilization. Basically because if it becomes very hot in the future, reducing emissions now of carbon dioxide will have a sizable impact on warming, say, 100, 200 years from now, while the impact of reducing methane now will be relatively small far off in the future when it becomes sort of hotter. And that is sort of a key reason why if we are pessimistic about the future, it is really CO2 that we need to worry about and that we should focus our climate policies on. But if you are really targeting, say, 1.5 degrees Celsius or 2 degrees Celsius, and if you believe that we will actually manage those temperature levels, it also becomes, in a relative sense, more important to also focus on methane.
Well, fossil fuel emissions have only increased in recent years and decades. We know that. Does that guarantee a faster rate of warming by increasing our rate of emissions? What do you think?
So basically, we know that we have a relatively linear relationship between cumulative amount of CO2 emissions and temperature level. And that basically implies that if you have constant emissions of carbon dioxide and entropic emissions going to the atmosphere, it will increase the global mean surface temperature roughly at a constant rate. So now the temperature contribution from CO2 is roughly 0.2 degrees Celsius per decade. That is sort of the rate of change in global mean surface temperatures, perhaps somewhat slightly higher. And that is sort of is related to the level of CO2 emissions we have for the moment. If we were to increase our amount of CO2 emissions per year, that increase in the rate and the rate of temperature change will also go up. So we know that sort of increasing CO2 emissions is causing a constant increase in the temperature of the Earth.
Well, let's go back to your study on aviation emissions and contrails. Daniel, you advised the auto industry on emissions regulations. What can you offer for the airline industry to help reduce their climate impact?
So basically, our starting point in this study was maybe not directly focusing on the airline industry, but rather to focus on if we want to sort of regulate the airline industry or have policies that are sort of incentivized reductions of a contrail serious forcing. So that was our starting point. So more from the regulatory perspective than the airline perspective. And the reason for that is that the European Commission has plans to have some type of regulation focusing on reducing contrails and other non-CO2 forced aviation within a couple of years from now. But also from an airline perspective, we hope that our research and numbers could contribute to make proper assessment of the worth of actually avoiding contrail series and to how to sort of value these reductions compared to potential increases in the CO2 emissions they may cause if they have rerouting of air flights as a strategy, for example.
Well, given current weather disasters and scientific predictions, I think we need to slash air travel to a tiny fraction of today's busy skies, at least until we can find a clean source of energy for flight. I worry a move to avoid contrails might decrease action to reduce mass air travel. Could efforts to control contrails delay fundamental emissions reductions?
I understand your worry, but from my perspective, and if our aim is to be consistent and really meet the Paris Agreement target, we need to move forward on all fronts, reducing sort of all types of entropic climate impact and not just focusing on CO2. We need to consider CO2, methane, nitrous oxide, and so on. So it's important to consider all sources contributing, entropic sources contributing to climate change. So that is sort of my perspective on it. It would be worrisome if it is used as an excuse to not developing clean fuels for aviation or not considering sort of reduction in flying, for example. But it's sort of be used in parallel with other strategies so we can meet sort of the climate targets in the Paris Agreement.
Over the years, you investigated many aspects of Earth systems. What are you working on next?
So for the moment, besides these issues of contrail and aviation, one of my key interests is this issue of overshoot in temperature levels. So basically, we have these targets of 1.5 up to 2 degrees Celsius within the Paris Agreement. But as the case is now, the global mean surface temperature has more or less already is close to the level of 1.5 degrees Celsius warming. And it's virtually certain that we cannot manage the 1.5 degree limit in the Paris Agreement without a temporary overshoot in the going up towards higher temperatures. And my research interests are partly are focusing on sort of what are the strategies and how can we plan for now for removing CO2 from the atmosphere, which could be a strategy to also reduce the global mean surface temperature. There could also be possibilities of removing methane from the atmosphere, which also could be a way of reducing the temperature after we have sort of passed this 1.5 degree target. So my research is focusing both on these strategies, understanding them, and also understanding them what type of policies could be used for incentivizing such futures, but also what could be the consequences of having a higher level of warming during a sort of a limited period and then sort of reduce the temperature of in the longer term.
From Chalmers University of Technology in Sweden, we've been talking with Associate Professor Daniel Johansson. Daniel will be a lead author in the next report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. You can find links to all the science we just discussed.